Hello. If you're hearing my voice right now, then you have stumbled onto the podcast where real stories of professional criminal profilers are told by professional assholes. Welcome to Profiling Pain. How's it going, co-filers? This is Chris Payne, your host. I'm here with...
Jaime En Fuego, yo. What up?
So, I know it's been kind of a while since you heard from us, but the numbers continue to climb. We get new subscribers every single day, so thank you very much for that. We're actually being listened to in five continents right now, which is pretty amazing.
It's a blessing and humbling, but awesome.
And by the time this actually releases, we should have a private Facebook group for all the co-filers, man. So, Profiling Pain, you guys can talk to us directly. You guys can even suggest cases you want to hear and talk amongst yourselves. And I mean, actually build a cool community out of this. I really like the idea that people are kind of climbing onto the Profiling Pain bandwagon, I suppose. So it's pretty sweet. We've got a lot of stuff going on. Currently, we've got, especially when it comes to Fuego and the Horror Show, which
yes,
we plug that often.
It's convention season. And so there's going to be the Phoenix Film Festival with its international horror and sci-fi branch. So if you're anywhere in the Arizona area, I mean, definitely come out to the Scottsdale 101. I believe it's April 4th through the 14th. And so you've got films going on at night and some stuff during the daytime. But if you like spooky and scary and weird stuff, hence kind of topics we cover here, yeah, you can definitely find some fun stuff there.
Yeah, and outside of that, it's also getting to be show season for Chiron. So we're going to be pretty busy this summer. Right now, we don't have too much booked up because we are in the process of recording. I know we keep saying that, but it's true. And then
it's a process.
It is a process.
That's what it boils down to. Even getting the stuff going today, we were just like, change this cable, so on and so forth. Let's hope everything works out.
Yeah, we're kind of working against Murphy's Law here. Anything that could go wrong has gone wrong, but I think we might be past that.
Fingers firmly crossed, sir.
We do have a set show date for July 19th. We're going to be playing in Chandler. More to come on that once the flyers and everything else approaches. But I can tell you it is all ages. The doors do open at 6, and it is $10 a ticket. And we'll probably have some pre-sale, and maybe we'll give some away through here. We'll give some away through Facebook for Chiron. Also, something I have been lacking that has been brought to my attention. I do not put any of the show links for anything that we do in any of the descriptions for the show. So anybody that's ever wanted to email us probably hasn't spelled it correctly because we haven't received too many of those. You guys have found my Instagram. You guys have found my personal Facebook, some of you freaks, which is all right.
They're out there. Yeah, I get it with Stephen King, so
really,
you know.
I don't mind the attention. But we haven't put any of the links in any of the show descriptions, so that's also going to change. So there will be a link to the Facebook page we're going to start. And then also,
I have those links in the YouTube version of this.
Okay,
that's the only
go.
Place I guess they're floating. So,
also, we're going to be recording a webisode for our YouTube page, which there'll be a link to, and that's at Centartainment on YouTube. We're trying to build that thing up. And soon.
That's for our goofy creativity, is the webisodes. That's like basically the behind the scenes of the Chiron silliness, is the best I can describe it as.
Yeah, it's when we get to do our stage personas, but in not such a serious light. So we're not screaming at you.
Kind of behind the screams,
a little
sort
bit.
Of thing.
Yeah, like that. And then what else? That's really about it right now.
Yeah, that's the roundtable for now.
Yeah, and then maybe if we get enough people subscribing to the Facebook page, we get a large enough community going, we'll start doing maybe monthly Ask Me Anythings. If there's any cases we cover and there's stuff that I leave stuff out of every case. I just – there's a lot of things that –
there's only so much you can get to, man.
Yeah, I try to keep just the important stuff in. So, I mean, it could be if you just want to BS with us, or if you want to ask specific questions about our fixation with this, or – anything, or if you just want to talk about how your day's going. So we might do an Ask Me Anything in a few weeks. We'll see. April will be really big for the show. And then that's it. So current events. Today is March 17th, 2019.
Paddy's Day, yo. Irish represent.
Happy St. Patrick's Day.
Not a happy subject we're talking about.
Yeah, unfortunately. Like, oh, man, how do we celebrate? Well, let's get drunk and talk about murderers. So, I don't know if you guys have been following the news or not, but Friday, so just 48 hours ago for us, New Zealand had their worst mass shooting. One man by the name of, when I can read my notes here, Brenton Harrison Tarrant. He live streamed on social media him going into two different mosques in New Zealand and killing upwards of 50 people, injuring even more. Which has brought a lot of different things to light. So there's a lot of debate on whether or not social media sites should be even offering live streaming anymore, which me and Fuego have discussed that takes away from so many artists if they do that.
Massively, in fact, and also because of the fact that it is the closest and most personal way that you can connect with your audience and interact with them. And I mean, you know, that's what, if you have your art of any kind, whether it's music, whether it's, you know, doing documentary, you know, kind of profiling type stuff like this, or whether it's, you know, making movies or TV or whatever the hell it may be, if you're in the creative sphere and you're making it or you're covering it, that's how you interact. And it's the best possible way to do it. And it's the most fulfilling way for your supporters, followers, friends, fans, whatever you want to say. So,
and not just that either. I mean, if you've got family on the other side of the country and you want them to enjoy in real time something that's going on at the family event, that's how you do it. I mean, we've done it. So, I mean, taking that away.
You said like baby showers and stuff. Yeah. Right? Yeah. I mean,
birthday parties. I mean, when I was working in New York, I actually, you know, it was through FaceTime, but it's the same principle. I was able to watch, you know, my son celebrate his birthday and Christmas and stuff like that, even though I was working 3,000 miles away from him. Yeah. So, I mean,
broadcasting to the public, though, you know, anybody can see it as opposed to a FaceTime, which is, you know, I don't know, man. It's a tough topic of censorship that scares me, you know, because you can't make everybody suffer just because of one, even if it is, like you said, you know, one bad apple spoiling the bunch and whatnot sometimes. Messing it up for everybody.
But. And then on top of that, to cover this guy, truly, he was actually obsessed with, do you remember a couple years ago that Norwegian massacre that happened? So that the guy that did the Norwegian massacre became this guy's, like, ha. That was his idol, what he wanted to be. Like, he talked about this guy in his manifesto a lot. He was also a self-proclaimed white supremacist, neo-Nazi, you know, white nationalist. Mm. And then what gets even weirder, just to keep it, because I know this is a profiling podcast, he actually inscribed on his guns the names of other mass shooters throughout the last few years. Right, he named his guns after other mass shooters.
Building creepy obsessiveness to an insane degree, man. And also happening in a country that I love the culture and, you know, whether it's, you know, comedy or, you know, Peter Jackson and horror that he did or whatever. And
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah, and it's just not to say that it hits so much harder because I have so much respect for the country and, you know, their people and stuff, but that's really the way I feel. So
yep. So, and it's affecting the political climate worldwide with his little manifesto there, because now, if you want to check out tally marks, there's actually more terrorists domestic and abroad. Yeah, there's more terrorist attacks domestic and abroad now of white supremacists than there are Muslims. Like, they're, you know, or of Islamic extremists. Sorry.
Now that was like a decade, 15 years ago, and it's still prevalent, especially if we see this particular shooting and the demographic that it went after and everything. I feel like that's why some of these shootings that are religiously based or racially based get more coverage than other, you know, high death toll stuff like we talked about.
Which brings to light the shooting in Brazil that happened 24 hours prior to this one, but it didn't get nearly the media coverage that this one did. And I think it has a lot to do with the white supremacist, has a lot to do with the religion aspect of it, has a lot to do, you know what I mean? There's a lot of different things. And I'm sure we'll get more information as time goes on about the Brazil shooting. I believe their new president, who they referred to as the South American Trump, he's going to be meeting with Trump, I believe, this week, and who knows what they're going to be discussing.
Surprise!
But it's just the political climate worldwide is crazy. Like, oh, they just had the whole conference they had just a couple weeks ago, or last week, I believe, it was with Kim Jong Un.
And they were walking around holding hands and everything.
Yeah, but per satellite imagery, they said that his nuclear factories are up and running again, and they're even predicting that he's going to be doing another missile test. When just a few months ago, him and Trump had the whole agreement. He wasn't going to do anything like that anymore. Like, you know, he was, you know, kicking little Kimmy in the nuts and everything's going to be fine.
So maybe Trump thinks that war with China is inevitable, and so he wants North Korea as an ally with nukes to destroy China.
You know what?
That's just me ranting on.
That is some crazy conspiracy theory, and I like it. So, but we're gonna go ahead and get into
that
our
case
now.
That was said in jest, by the way.
Which, you know what, some of the craziest things are usually ones that end up being true. Kind of like today's case.
Sometimes life is stranger than fiction.
So today we're going to cover the Hillside Stranglers. We're also going to cover, you know, nature versus nurture, as well as one of our guys, once he gets caught in the whole thing, he's one of the first people to actually get onto the stand and have multiple personalities on the stand. His name is Kenneth Bianchi, but he blames Steve for all the stuff that happens.
And yet he was deemed fit to go to trial and everything and actually be on the witness stand despite all of that.
The thing about it, as we'll get into on the next episode, is that the main detective the entire time just went, bullshit. Like, he didn't believe a thing coming out of this guy's mouth. But that's going to be on a later episode.
He was faking insanity to try to get away with it, sort of thing.
Well, that's maybe what they say. That's what one guy believed. And then a lot of there's specifically who we'll cover. There was one therapist who was like, no, I believe it through and through. This is really happening. And when everybody else is like, no, bad. So anyway, we're gonna get cover that. But first, as we often do, we're going to start with location and the early years. So the majority of these actually took place just outside the Hollywood Hills in Glendale, California. And they became known as the Hillside Stranglers because they would do their deeds one spot.
And it is Hillside Stranglers, plural, right?
Yeah. Well, at the beginning of the case, which I didn't really feel was that important, they were like, oh, so one person was just a Hillside Strangler in original tabloids. But then the extent of DNA testing, which we'll cover, showed that there was two people, and we'll get into how they figured that out.
That's what I was trying to clarify. I was like, we got a plural thing going down here?
Yeah. And let's just get into it.
Yes.
All right. So from October of 1977 to February of 1978, a total of 10 girls and women ranging in ages from 12 to 27 were kidnapped, raped, and killed.
Now, I'm sick already.
Yeah, it's one of those. We're taking this to 11 again, guys. So the two
monsters
responsible came to be known as the Hillside Stranglers because the majority of the bodies were found on hillsides in the Los Angeles area. So this episode is going to be dark, and once again, we're going to be heavy. So the two creatures responsible were kind of classic adaptations of what you would consider being two people who couldn't do it without each other. They both had the capabilities in themselves to eventually pull this off, but it's almost like justifying it for one another made them able to really come together to make one pure asshole. You know, it's like Wonder Twin Powers activate form of disturbed.
It's like making the opposite of the Megazord, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Except with two pieces together. And I got to say, I like how you called them creatures because they're obviously not human beings. They're sick pieces of crap, you know. They're creatures. They're subhuman.
One of them is
to do stuff like this.
One of them is just completely fucked up from jump, and the other one you can kind of see was made. So it's almost like it's kind of like how Richard Chase was so screwed up, and then everybody kind of failed him along the way, so he never got fixed. So one person's life started off really hard, another person was born, bred, raised, and died an asshole. And that's the first one we're going to cover. His name is Angelo Bono. All right? And it's spelt like Bueno, but it's pronounced Bono. It's Italian.
I was wondering.
Now, he was born October 5th, Bono. 1934 in Rochester. When his parents got a divorce, he moved with his mother and his older sister to the south part of Glendale, California in 1939.
Other side of the country. Crazy.
Yeah. So his mother, working at a shoe factory, herself and her kids, still found time somehow to take her kids to church. Now, however, a Catholic mass in school had no effect on Angelo. He remained uneducated throughout his entire life and never, ever possessing a positive moral compass. So as a teenager, he actually idolized a convicted robber, kidnapper, and rapist, Carol Chessman. Now, he was called the Red Light Bandit. Now, Carol Chessman... this dude actually had a poster of Carol Chessman like on his wall, like it was crazy. So
I've heard the name thrown around before. Yeah. It was obviously somebody who almost like natural born killer status,
yes,
got fame through their robbing.
Exactly.
Kind of thing. Bonnie and Clyde status.
I'm not 100% sure, but I think Carol Chessman might have actually been one of the people, because it happened a lot. Like Richard Ramirez, a lot of these guys actually ended up getting married while in prison just from having fans.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah, it's sick. It's twisted, but they became rock stars at some point.
Women love this stuff, man. I don't get it.
Now, Bono was actually what you would consider a sex offender from childhood, even getting kicked out of school for grabbing girls in the bathroom. And he often boasted to his friends about raping and sodomizing girls. Like, that's just the personality that this cocksucker had. Now, not surprising that Angelo would get in trouble with the law throughout his entire life. He had his first child in 1956, which, holy crap, I can't imagine us having kids. And he even was married once or twice. But he married the mother this first time. However, he left her a week after and never even giving her a cent for the baby and completely just avoiding all responsibility for the child.
That happened a lot of the time. It happened to Stephen King's dad in the 50s. His dad just disappeared, and so he just grew up with a mother.
Yeah, and he wouldn't, and when the short time he even like saw the boy later on in life, he refused to even let the kid call him dad. Like, he was that kind of prick. Now, he actually had multiple children and multiple wives throughout the years, and he abused all of them, physically and sexually. He would, one time, he actually raped one of his wives in front of his kids, saying that they had to learn. Even raping his own daughter and then passing her to his friends, saying that we need to make her good at sex because she's not going to be worth anything else later in life. The man hated his children, hated himself. Yeah, he was was a bastard.
Now, you just killed me with that last line of conscience. Yeah. Like, holy crap.
I'm telling you. So now, outside of just being complete evil, he also found time to build a good reputation as an auto upholsterer. He even...
He had the two-face thing going on, obviously. Yeah. He had the image that, you know, was purported to everybody as far as professionally, and then there was the behind-the-scenes insanity of his life.
And side note, he actually did the upholstery on one of Frank Sinatra's vehicles. So that's... I mean, he was a damn good upholsterer. If he just made that...
If he's around Hollywood, man. I mean, and he's good at what he does. Yeah. Or was.
No. So eventually he actually bought a place at 703 East Coronado Street. It was his residence and his upholstering shop. So he lived and worked out of the same building. He never really had to leave. Now, living alone and having no employees, he did everything himself. He was able to do whatever he wanted, whenever he wanted.
Since it's obviously post all the marriages and kids, and he just went into like exile, so to speak.
Now, there's a lot of talk, actually, that Bono was... what you would call, I guess, a smooth talker. Like, he was, every woman that's ever come in contact with him said that he would start off super sweet to get what he wanted, and then the dude was just insane. He was very abusive, and he only cared for sodomy. Like, he was just insane. So it was all behind, you know what I mean? He was just a freak when it came to that. Now, that's Bono. That, in a nutshell, that's his entire personality. That's his
makeup. That's his MO. That's his profile, so to speak.
Upholstery and sodomy. That's all he did. Now, for number
two. Time for upholstery and sodomy.
Kenneth Bianchi. All right, Kenneth Alessio Bianchi. He's more of a sad case. Now, he was born May 22nd in 1951 in Rochester, New York as well. Now, his mother was actually a 17-year-old alcoholic prostitute that gave him up at birth.
Good Lord.
Now, he spent...
Adoption services, then?
Yeah. So, he went into foster care immediately, and he spent the first 3 months of his life pretty much bouncing between foster home and foster home, and pretty much only being left in a corner or bassinet. He never really truly felt human affection or human touch for the first 3 months of his life. Right, which they say that the first 6 months of a child being born,
so
it's crucial.
Much groundwork, man. Yeah.
So he spent the first 3 months of his life just crying in a corner, like never. And there's actually a study out there saying that the more a child cries and goes unattended, it's supposed to do something to their stress levels in their body, and it actually increases their adrenaline and their their aggressiveness. Like, a child will become more. I hate to relate it to like animals or anything like that.
No, that's wild. Well, we are animals of an elevated variety. Yeah.
Yeah. So what it is it creates a higher level of aggressiveness in children, and that's how you get more bullies and stuff like that. There are people who have never really been coddled or cuddled. You know what I mean? And I actually read a book a long time ago called The Human Mind, and there was a study done where they took two kids, right? And this was like in the 1940s. And one kid was just given the necessities to maintain. It was a set of twins. And then the other child was actually loved, nurtured, you know, whatever. So by the late teens, early 20s, the other kid had committed suicide after doing drugs and getting in all kinds of trouble. And then the one that was actually like catered to and loved and everything else ended up getting a college degree, probably becoming a doctor. Like, they didn't really, I read it so long ago. And it could have even just been made up. It could have been a theory. But because I don't remember exactly but the book was called The Human Mind.
Okay, well, just to chime in, though, it seems like the correlation is clear for the sheer fact that if in those instances of, like, formitude and where you have to lay that, you know, very important just behavioral norms and stuff like that, you have to actually experience it from, you know, somebody to actually pass that energy, that teaching, that, you know, whatever along. And if you never felt it during those like very first moments and first, you know, months of life, it would obviously be tough, especially late in the game, to actually, you know, have that set in, that principle, that behavioral mentality.
Right.
And so then how can you put it out into the world if you didn't experience it initially the way you were supposed to? So it makes sense, man. I mean,
now things didn't persist that way for Bianchi. Actually, he ended up going the opposite direction once he finally was adopted. Now, eventually being adopted by Frances Bianchi and her husband, by the time he could talk, his parents were already aware of the fact that they were dealing with a compulsive liar. Now, he would make up crazy stories, and he would just off the wall things, and then like most people at the age of seven, he suffered. Most serial killers. If you go and check the study, he actually fell out of a tree and busted his noggin pretty good to the point where he had multiple concussions. And his mother, this time, As opposed to just being left in a corner for 3 months, this woman was overbearing as hell. I mean, over-smothering, over, you
and know. And there's a balance there, too. Right. And, you know, it's just different times in those formative periods.
So much so that after the head injury, she pulled him out of school for the remainder of the year and pretty much kept him in the house. He was not to go anywhere or do anything.
Okay. Now, psycho status.
Now,
yeah.
Shortly Norman after, Bates. Yeah. Now, shortly after the head injury, he started having mal seizures, but at the time, his mother thought that it was just like entranced daydreaming. But if you looked at the kid, his eyes would roll
into... Aren't they very similar? I mean,
well, his eyes would roll into the back of his head, and she thought that he was just having crazy, crazy daydreams. Took him to the doctor, and the doctor said, no, he's having mal seizures. He's having mild seizures. It's not just daydreaming and drifting off. But she was mixing that with the compulsive lying, you know. And then, to keep going...
Well, which is what I was thinking, too, for a second until... Yeah.
And then to keep going with the McDonald triad... The kid, which we discussed on the Richard Chase episode, the kid developed a really serious wedding problem. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't just bedwetting. He would pee himself constantly. So much so that the mom, Frances, thinking that she could get him, you know, punished to not do these things, would give him like a preemptive ass whooping, like, you better not pee your pants. And he would still do it to the point where they started calling it dribbling. He would dribble or he'd piddle or they had some cute little nickname for it. But she was so panicked and so worried about his health that she started taking him to doctor after doctor after doctor. Now, it's not one doctor. It's multiple doctors.
And in turn, doing that, though, can mess kids up from being just the whole poked and prodded aspect for so damn long.
And it wasn't just the poked and prodded aspect. It's the
fact
that
it
all,
revolved
around his genitals because of the bedwetting problem.
So, oh, God.
So the multiple doctors he would go to...
Sort of weird shit you'll be into or what could actually arouse you after all of that strange stuff going on.
And he even talked about it later, saying that it was almost the equivalent of rape in his mind because he would see almost six doctors a week, and it was multiple doctors. Being roped in, drop your pants, check you out, do this, do that, you know. And then on top of that, having the overbearing mother at home. And then the father figure...
And who knows if he was sexually abused to some degree, even if not completely intentionally from parents trying to, you know, like whatever
it's,
with
and
his
it's
little
a sincere
wing.
Possibility, yeah. And I mean, I'm sure... I mean, it was, you know, 1950s and 60s. I'm sure there was good intentions behind it.
Yeah,
you know,
and
a panicked mother.
And that's why I backed off on saying sexually abused because almost like an inadvertent sexual abuse
it was
based on that type of just trying to diagnose at home, which is usually what a lot of parents do in situations like that.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're like, okay, it's still not working, whether discipline or whatever. Now I take him to doctors.
So. Yeah, so severe head injury mixed with, you know, not knowing any affection for the first part of his core development.
Yeah, this is a perfect storm for psychosis, unfortunately.
Yeah, exactly.
That's really what it's boiling down to.
And then once he started actually kind of developing a relationship with the father, the adoptive father, that man dies when he's 11. Right when he's getting ready to
move
into puberty.
Right when there could be some potential leeway.
Exactly.
And actually, and when puberty hits, that's another of those pivotal periods where you can curb a lot of behaviors. Yep. You really
can. A lot
can.
Of psychologists will tell you that at age 12, your child is what's the word? They're turning into something that they're not ready to turn into yet. Their body's, I mean, abruptly changing. That preteen stage
it's
right
It's all
there.
That hormonal stuff, man. And it clouds judgments. But it also, it almost like softens the clay a little bit.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you have a better potential to mold a better person as a parent, as a good example, as somebody actively involved in their lives. Sometimes it takes more effort than some with others. But, you know, it's a key window.
And the kid just keeps experiencing loss after loss, you know, whether it be loss of the original parent, loss of this new parent, loss of innocence in the way that he's looking at life, you know.
And pick me up just to throw me down. And that takes its toll too, man.
And then loss of social skills by being pulled out of school for God knows how long he was out of school. An overbearing mother, overprotective, not really able to venture out and having to create these fantasies in his own mind, which if you spend too much time with yourself, you'll manifest terrible things, which is what he did. He actually... Growing up, he was very timid. He was very shy. He was actually really, really nice. Everybody described him as sweet. Like, everybody called him Kenny. Like, endearing. He was just Kenny. Yeah, Kenny.
Mm-hmm.
And any woman he ever actually dated even said that he was super sweet. You know, he was overly jealous and would throw fits like a child because that's just kind of the mentality he had.
Yeah. Man-child happens with a lot of those kind of kids.
Yeah, but for the initial courting and even just being in the relationship, he was always very sweet, very kind, unless he didn't get his way. But it wasn't like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It was more like a man to a child. Now,
interesting.
Yeah. So eventually, out of high school, he ended up getting married right out of high school, right away. And then they just split. He wasn't responsible enough. He wasn't ready for it. They just split. They would actually, when they would argue, they would each call their mothers. They both had overbearing mothers. And that was, they would actually talk through their mothers and have their mothers talk to them.
Yeah, that's what happened with so many of those kids in that era, man. Yep. I mean, because if you wanted to have sex, you had to get married. It was basically what it boiled down to with the social norms and perceptions and everything. And so there were a lot of marriages that much, much fewer ended back then, you know, because of the fact that it was frowned upon so often. And so that would probably almost heighten the likelihood of when, you know, two people shouldn't have got married and yet they're going to try to stick it out and they hate each other. And that heightens the likelihood for domestic abuse and all kinds of different stuff.
And so the crazy thing about it is that you mix all these things together and the guy actually had an IQ of 116. Yeah, so he wasn't, Einstein status, but he was still pretty damn smart.
Yeah, sharp, man.
And he realized that at a very young age. So he would try to manipulate his wife. He'd try to manipulate
it. The lying you said as a kid. Yeah. I mean, I don't think a really, really dumb kid, I guess it all depends on, you know, how savvy and, like, kind of sneaky you are about your lies and how well thought out it is. That's obviously the sign of a smarter kid.
The problem is that he would put more effort into his lies and creating the story around them than he would actually put into just doing what he's supposed to. And that was another complaint about his wife, is that he was an underachiever. I don't know how else to explain that. He would underachieve so much but overdo all these elaborate stories to do something greater. Like, we're going
to
cover...
Isn't that a lot of people in the creative sphere, though? You have to dream big, but, I mean, it's always tough to actually accomplish your aspirations.
So after they ended up splitting, he was just down. He couldn't pick himself back up. And his mother actually entered a new relationship, because now we're in his late teens, early 20s. His mother is now distracted with another relationship. In her eyes, Kenneth is a man, so you got to learn your own thing. You got to do something else. And Candace was telling her, you know, I don't think that I can achieve anything here in Rochester. And she said, well, I'll call your cousin Angelo in L.A., and I'll send you out there. He's a man. He'll man you up. So now he goes to L.A.
I got some L.A. Italians. I'll man you up, you know.
And he's sleeping on Angelo Bono's couch. So now...
So they were cousins.
They were cousins, exactly.
Now, have they met really too much before?
Not too much. There's about a 20-year split between the two of them, too. Like I said, 1951, 1934.
Yeah.
So a 17-year difference. But he's moving in with essentially cousin Angelo, and he's going to show him the ropes.
He's got a big brother now, you know?
So Bianchi moving in with Angelo, seeing how Angelo treated women and seeing how Angelo, he became obsessed with the sex and the drugs and just the lifestyle of L.A. in the 1970s.
Which was nuts.
But Angelo didn't have any doors on his rooms. He didn't have, it was bare bones. I don't think he even had a stove in his house.
Full on flop house, man.
Right, exactly. So Angelo kind of got tired of Bianchi just kind of hanging around and was like, you got to go. You got to get off my couch. I don't want you here anymore. You're messing up my vibe. And so they lived together for about 3 months until Angelo kicked him out. When he kicked him out, Bianchi actually tried his first real love, like career-wise. He wanted to be a police officer so bad, but that's where the underachieving portion came in. He couldn't pass the physical. He couldn't even, he just didn't study for any of the tests, but he would do ride-alongs all the time. He's obsessed with doing ride-alongs. But he eventually just took his, he took a shot and went and got a normal job as an insurance adjuster, I believe. So when Ken moved out, he moved into an apartment on 809 East Garfield Avenue and bought himself a 1972 Cadillac sedan. He got a job.
Bono working on it. I wanted to get in the detail all nice and stuff.
Now, he ended up taking a job as for a title company. Now, using the money, that's what he did. He went and bought himself that Cadillac and everything else. And then he started hitting on every single female he saw in the apartment complex. Now, eventually being turned
down. Cast your line, man.
Yeah, being turned down right and left. He actually ended up meeting Kelly Boyd and moved in with Kelly Boyd. It's a woman he actually had met through work. Now, in May of 1977, he was told he would be a father. So he was going to be a dad. He's got a baby on the way. Now, he wanted to marry Kelly and did everything he could to convince her, but she wasn't sure about the plan. Although he was kind to her, he kind of had a number of problems with responsibility, financial stability, and on top of
all the stuff just continuing.
And on top of that, she said that he was just a jealous person and lied too much. But she never left him. She stuck it out, hoping for the best, but she just didn't marry him at this time.
She probably cared for him, but, you know.
Now, his lies were so ridiculous that he actually ended up putting out an ad in the paper saying that he was hiring psychologists for his office that he didn't own. He went and rented offices in downtown Los Angeles. And when somebody finally added the application, you know, put in the application, he just took their credentials and copied his name over it and hung it up in his office and tried to get as many clients as he could in using a fake psychology degree. When Kelly found out about that, she was kind of like, what the hell are you doing?
Yeah, this is way deeper than we thought.
And he would just lie about it, like, oh, I didn't tell you that I went to psychology school while I was in Rochester, and like just make up shit because he didn't want to work a regular job. He wanted to be a sheriff. He wanted to be a psychologist. He would just make up things of that
nature.
Wasn't
willing to put the dues in, huh?
Exactly.
Just jump right to it.
Now, he had lost his original job. He ended up not being able to afford the offices to be a psychologist anymore. And he turned to Angelo when he's having money problems. And Angelo said, hey, why don't you and that fucking Cadillac come over here? Because I started a new pimping business.
Just like I was thinking. Oh, wait, way beyond what I was thinking.
So Angelo started a pimping business and decided to bring in Bianchi because he had the right vehicle and he needed a partner. Now, Bianchi, Kenneth, was obsessed with the way he saw Angelo treat women. And now he thought that he finally had the chance to treat women the way that he believed they should be treated.
As whores.
So they had a couple of run-ins with some early girls that ended up actually moving to Arizona. I didn't write down the name. I was saving her backstory for later for a future episode. But just a quick side note. They tried to get her, treated her like crap. She ran away, ended up getting saved by this lawyer, right, who was a criminal defense lawyer. And when Kenneth Bianchi and Angelo Bono found out, they called the lawyer and said, you know what, we're going to handle you. We're going to take you out, da-da-da. This lawyer had actually covered a lot of cases for Hell's Angels and made a call into a couple friends, and Bianchi and Angelo ended up getting the shit kicked out of
them. I was going to say, bad motherfuckers.
So they weren't very good, and they decided, you know what, we need to do a little bit safer with the pimping game, and they came across two prostitutes who had promised them a list of clients that did in-house calls. So they would just send the prostitutes to them and kind of just be the middleman, just set that whole thing up. Now, when it turned out that that list was for clients who would go to hotels or, you know, I guess, venture out as opposed to house calls, they felt slighted, they felt betrayed, and they wanted revenge. So it was just the one little token they needed to push them over the edge.
Dang.
Now, the two working ladies' names are Yolanda Washington. All right, now she was a Hollywood prostitute, and alongside her friend, Deborah Noble. Now, when they purchased the list of clients from them, and
so a Hollywood prostitute. We're talking the kind Hugh Grant was all about.
Right. So when they found out that the client list was wrong and went looking for them, they had no idea where to find either one of these women, except for they remembered that Yolanda Washington had accidentally mentioned where specifically she worked on Hollywood. So now they
like
knew
her actual real job or just
her beat. Yeah, exactly. Now, not being able to find Noble, who actually sold them the list, they figured they would take out their frustrations on Yolanda.
Oh, jeez.
So
this was this was breaking the camel's back and actually going through with their first bit of.
Exactly. So the two men, all right, went looking for revenge. And the way that they went about it, especially with Bianchi's obsession with wanting to be a police officer, is they would actually pose as police officers. They picked Yolanda Washington up, took her to a undisclosed location, raped her, strangled her, and left her on the hillside. So in 1977...
So that's right. That was their spot to dump the bodies, hence the name.
Yeah. So on October 17th of 1977, the Glendale police now had a brand new murder case that they had absolutely no clue how far this would stretch. We're talking it actually covered over two states. They ended up having cases in Washington and California, and that's a long stretch.
I was
going to
say, yeah, ways away, man, up in the Seattle area.
Yeah, over 10 women. This is just the first one, and... Yolanda Washington, October 17, 1977. This is the beginning of the case that would be known forever, the Hillside Stranglers. And that's where I'm going to leave this one. It's a very short episode. I want to cover current events.
It's an intro. It's just giving us that first taste of what these guys were capable of. And I'm sickly captivated to some degree, but I don't know, man. Just the progression for these guys and the pieces that were in place initially for this to transpire.
And just to
have that one thing to just, it's like the Pandora's box opening when you cross a line like that, you know? And then, of course, it's like, hey, all is fair game, man.
Yeah,
whatever.
It's the little allowances that they started giving themselves.
Exactly.
Especially Bono with what he would do with women. But it's the little allowances that they started giving themselves in the way that they would justify it to each other.
Well, and also the way the energy rubbed off between the two guys. And so how there was, the one aspect of the lying, all these different things. He almost needed that other nasty presence to bring him around full circle. It was
two halves of the whole asshole.
Yeah. And as you mentioned earlier, and so that guy probably could have to some degree, if having the right push in a positive direction in those little windows, maybe not ended up on a course like this.
See, a part of me thinks that Bianchi wouldn't be able to kill on his own.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying.
But the fourth episode, we're going to cover a conspiracy theory.
Fourth portion of this new set of episodes.
It's actually a cold case. It's never been solved, and Bianchi's name comes up in a lot of the descriptions. Mm. So it's one of those things where it's like, could he have or could he not have? And as we cover his personality more and more as we go through.
And see the progression of all of it. Yeah.
You still think, I don't know if he could. But as we get towards the end, there's certain little, like I said, allowances that he gives himself. You're like, man, he's got some ticks. The dude actually... If you've ever seen the movie Split, it's like that.
I've seen Split. I've seen Glass. I've seen them all, man.
He's got some ticks.
Split was great.
And Bono, I don't think Bono ever hid his intentions. He was just a monster from jump.
Yeah, and that's where I was saying the difference between the two is that one was on the edge and needed the proper push to fall into it. But then once he was there, he was almost probably smarter than the other guy and more wicked to some degree because he had that intellect and, in comparison.
And on the last episode...
I mean, the other guy seems like raw, brutish... like stupidity and so on,
And on the last episode, we covered how certain agencies refuse to work together because they want to get the caller. This episode, we get to cover how two police stations from two different states actually combined to make all of this work. So this is going to be a really cool transition out of that. So we've covered head injury, nature versus nurture, stuff like that, but we're going to move on and actually talk about certain aspects of profiling that actually helped solve this case, how DNA testing started taking off during this time frame.
During this case specifically, it was
one of the first times
we
were able to check. So and then on top of that, really quick, I know we're spending a lot of time in the 1970s in California, and I read the other day actually that a theory is floating around that it was like right after the height of everybody using lead-based fuel for their vehicles and the crazy amounts of pollution in California.
Yeah,
they're saying that the lead in the pollution in California is what was making people just go nuts after a while.
I would not be surprised, man.
Yeah. So there's a lot of really cool, it's not even just the case itself, but there's just a lot of really interesting psychological things happening in just that atmosphere alone. And it's the elements around them. It's the nature. It's also just people in general in that neck of the country.
There was culturally, socially, and obviously chemically too. So.
Yeah, there's just so many things.
Environmentally,
making all this crazy stuff manifest. And
Perfect storm, like I said earlier, dude.
We could spend an entire season in the 1970s in California, but I want to get to these guys next because, as I said in the last episode, Richard Chase was following this case. He was a huge fan of what was going on here. So then it all ties into that conspiracy theory on the last episode of this that we're gonna do. So it's just a really cool tying into each other and stuff like that. So I mean, but yeah, anyway, that's it. Thank you guys so much for listening to this episode. I know it was kind of short. We talked about a lot of stuff and tried to cram it all in.
It was a precursor, kind of preview episode of the ongoing coverage on this case.
Yeah, this is almost like a Sam's Club sample size. So
it's free too, so I mean, come on.
But the next episode, we're going to dive into the other nine women. We're going to describe a lot about that. We're going to talk about Kenneth's home life. Bono just stays Bono, so we don't have to cover him quite as much. Just, you know, hey, Bono. Is he still a dick? He's still a dick. And then, but Kenneth, he is a fascinating character, and you're going to get to see a lot of just, I don't know if it's his own genius in a sense, or if it's just he's insane. But we're going to have some funny stories about him on the next one that are going to, I mean, he spends way more time lying and trying to live out these lies than he does doing anything else. And somehow still found time to murder. So, and, real quick, I'll leave you with this.
The sign of a true maniac, though, man.
Yeah, his code word for going and doing these terrible things with Bono was he'd always tell his wife, I got to go play cards with Angelo, but you're more than welcome to come if you want. And he knew that his wife, Kelly, hated Bono. She's like, I hate that guy. I'm not going. And so for all you guys out there, if you ever want to be like, oh, I'm going to go do this, just invite the girlfriend, invite the wife, especially if you know she hates the guy. And then it's like, well, you can't say I didn't invite you. And that's your cop-out. I'm not saying murder. I'm just saying if you want free pass to hang out with your butts. Mm-hmm. But anyway.
Yeah, we're not condoning hall passes or anything like that, guys. Come on.
But once again, check out Centartainment. Email us at centartainment@gmail.com. Check out facebook.com/ Chiron Band AZ. Centartainment on YouTube. Reverb Nation at Chiron Band or reverbnation.com/ Chiron Band AZ.
Correctamundo. Same on Facebook, too.
That's right. We'll have more information on shows. I'm OmegaTwiz5150 on Instagram. And Fuego is
Yeah, I'm basically Jaime en Fuego on all social media sectors, J-A-I-M-E, so kind of like Jamie, but it's like some Spanish pronunciation, y'all. So yeah, Jaime en Fuego, E-N-F-U-E-G-O, Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, and with the Infuegotainment, but also got to give a shout out where Chiron has done some stuff previously, which is to youtube.com/thehorrorshow channel. And yeah, lots of spooktacular coverage going down there too, sometimes 3 episodes a day, everything from reviews to trailer reactions, convention coverage, and video game Let's Plays. And Chiron has done some music stuff on there too. If you search Crossing the Streams in the playlists, you will find back when we were getting copyright hit for every single episode we were doing. But some were demonetized and some were, you know, we had to trim videos out. But it's a fun playlist, and we're looking around trying to figure out how to pursue that coverage again, maybe just on a different platform, so to speak.
Yeah. But outside of that, man, you guys have been amazing, and this has been Profiling Pain. So stay metal, mofos, and we'll catch you on the next episode.
Peace out.